Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle, which is coming right up. First, a few thoughts of my own. Every year when the season changes, when we get out of winter into spring, I am so grateful. I do not envy people who live in places where there is no change of season. I am not consumed with envy for those in San Diego. Sorry, good viewers and listeners in San Diego, I don't think you've got it made. I like the punctuation of nature. And partly that is because I grew up in Central Africa and every day the weather was just the same. So much so that for 6 months of the year, they announced on the radio that there would be no further weather reports for 6 months because there was no point in weather reports. Well, it's all very nice, but it's a bit bland. It lacks drama. It lacks passion. Weather is drama and passion. Winter is the height of drama. I think we need it. I think it keeps us going. I think that it gives us a certain drive that we don't have if we don't have change of season. There's something a little bland about sweet days of sunshine day after day. Today, we're going to talk about inclusion and diversity, or diversity, inclusion. And we have a very special guest to help us with that. First, of course, I'm joined by my co-host, as usual, Linda Gasparello, and our special guest, and it's sure delight to have you on the broadcast, is Naomi Thompson, Associate Vice President, Office of Community Equity and Diversity, University of Rhode Island. I hope you don't try to put that on a badge at any time. That would be a little tough. She is the university's chief diversity officer. Naomi, what does a diversity officer do?
The diversity officer is the person who thinks about the university from top to bottom through a lens of all aspects of diversity. And it's a position that has evolved out of many different roles. Traditionally, when I began in this field, it was a job that evolved out of the Office of Affirmative Action, Equal Opportunity, and Diversity. And over time, that has expanded. I think the traditional view is to look at the interest of traditionally underrepresented people. And historically, that has included women and people of color and ethnic minority and racial minorities. But diversity has grown. And now it's a field that includes issues of ability and disability, religion, a religious creed, veteran status, and LGBTQ or gender and sexuality issues, along with issues of age, looking at the multiple intersecting identities of an individual and then how those interests need to be protected and how those interests need to be celebrated as well.
Celebrated is probably the bit of this that I like the sound of.
Oh, yes.
Because when you get it done right, you get a much richer culture. If you get it wrong, you get acrimonious culture. Arguing about your piece of turf or the piece of turf that you claim for your particular constituency. But the idea of celebrating it, of something solid and positive and great coming out of it, as happens, say, in music, that's very special. Linda, what do you think?
But I think celebrating, but also recognizing that diversity is the way of the United States now. I mean, there was a recent Census Bureau report which said that in 2044, there will be no white majority anymore, that we will actually be a no-majority America. And, you know, that's really already happening here in the United States. Here in 2015, if you are a child who is five or under, that's happening for you already. If you are someone who is under 30, this is just, in another decade, we're going to see the deepening of a trend that we've already seen, which is urban areas, you know, on both coasts and the Southwest, which have this no majority. Mm-hmm. It's something that everybody's paying attention to politically. It's combined with a lot of trends that are happening, things like interracial marriages are on the upswing. There are going to be states like Texas, Florida, Georgia, California, about 16 states that are not going to have a white majority in the next, you know, next 16 years or so, next 12 years or so.
I want to talk about, in this hunt for diversity, which tends to come with looking for those who are not performing as well and bringing them in and bringing them up. Do we put people under irrational pressure? I wonder about that. There's this book which points to a young science student who went to Brown University in Providence, mm-hmm. Rhode Island, and it was Malcolm
Gladwell
of the New Yorker, and she was put and she was very bright. She was exceptional in high school, but she was put into such a competitive environment as a science undergraduate that she felt the pressure was too great. And in the end, she peeled off and took an easier way out, still at the same university, but in liberal arts and some. And he thought, and he himself has a diverse background, so he can say this, I think, that this was a function of pushing people too hard in order to achieve a kind of prima facie balance, where there really was not a balance. Do you deal with that at all? Do you deal with kids who are out of their depth, but people want them there for some reason?
Absolutely, to a certain extent. So mm-hmm. let me just bring the perspective that we look at. When we do diversity work, when I do diversity work, I do not see excellence and diversity and inclusion mutually exclusive, absolutely. I see them as very much in sync, and that they are things that we look for in students, faculty, and staff. And these are characteristics that we have found in our students, faculty, and staff, that they bring excellence, they bring education, wisdom, a passion for their work. I think that the field of education is inherently uneven from the beginning, that from the time students or young children enter into Head Start or preschool, that there is an imbalance and it just becomes the achievement gap.
An imbalance that comes from the economic, social background, but and also the family life.
It comes from a number of factors.
There's a very interesting piece in the current, or last week's Economist newspaper, which deals with the flood of students into magnet schools, mm-hmm. and how directly correlated their success in those schools is to the homes they come from. Mm-hmm. Asian children tend to be pre-prep, pre-pushed, pushed. Mm-hmm. Whites somewhere down in the middle, and Hispanics and African Americans less so. As the Economist says rather cruelly, they just want to keep them out of trouble. They don't have this high aspiration for them. And children are, to some extent, the products of their parents' aspirations rather than their own aspirations. So we have to look at that, too. And you're trying to counter for that, do you?
I think that you have to account for the different learning styles that children have, and that schools are often geared to a certain population towards how they learn, and that students need to be met where they are with their particular learning styles, but all students need to be held to a high standard. All students need to be given an opportunity to learn. One of the flagship programs at the University of Rhode Island is our talent development program, wherein we admit a significant number of traditionally underrepresented students, but they're given the support that they need. They're given the academic support that they need. They're given additional counseling and advising so that they can be successful. And higher ed is constantly looking at ways that we can close the achievement gap and increase our graduation rates and improve the quality of education for all students and make it, because it benefits the entire country when we educate all of our students.
Have you increased the graduation rate through the program? Tell us about that rate.
Have I increased it? No.
No, but I mean, have you through the program?
I think
the program.
The University of Rhode Island has been very intentional about how we recruit, admit, and progress students through. And so our graduation rates are in need of improvement, but over time, the talent development program has produced more and more students who are productive. So Look at the mayor of Providence. He is a product of the talent development program.
He's Hispanic.
Yeah, he's a Latino gentleman.
Mr. Elorza.
Yeah, Jorge Elorza, but he is the product of talent development. So it's the quality of graduates as well as the quantity of graduates and what they're going out into the world and doing. They're impacting states, cities, and going on to do wonderful things in the world. And so there's much to be proud of the students who come through the talent development program mm-hmm. and also students
who... By the way, the originating program station for this program is Howard University mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C., a predominantly African-American university mm-hmm. with some astounding graduates.
Absolutely, yes.
I meet and in the course of entirely different business. I meet them in the electric industry. I meet
medicine.
Them in medicine. And it's very gratifying to know that we're associated with that university and with that station. I wonder, do we overrate and overemphasize college education in America?
Personally, I don't think so. I think it's very expensive. So I think the cost of education is high, but I think that having a college education is so important to our...
But what are you saying to people who don't have one? Aren't you saying you are the damned, you are the inferior, you are the second class,
yeah, right.
You will walk three paces behind for life, and you will be certainly behind in your earnings? We've talked on this program before, and you have not been party to it, of course, about what I call the mortarboard ceiling. We know about the glass ceiling, yeah. We know about the color bar, but the mortarboard ceiling, where young people, I used to talk to them in Washington on the subway, mm-hmm. who feel really, because they're not going to go to college for various reasons, and feel very, that this is some sort of mark of Cain on them, that they're going to be regarded as inferior for all time. And it's not just African-American students by any means whatsoever. So I just wonder what you think about that. Do we not get so carried away with the value of college, some college graduates being extraordinary and some being not much better than high school, the good high school, haven't we sort of skewed things to a reverence for higher education that may be misplaced?
I think it's individually driven. I have a family member who never graduated from college and barely graduated from high school and went on to trade school and became enormously successful as an entrepreneur. But this individual had drive, had passion, had a hard work ethic, and was committed to doing the work to get her to the place where she owns her own business.
And intellectual liberty.
Maybe. But maybe it was guidance. Maybe it was mentorship.
I'm provoking you a little bit here.
Yes, you are. And I don't mind it at all.
Because I wonder about this. What I call intellectual liberty is people who don't come up through formal educational mm-hmm. systems and therefore find the world for themselves. And mm-hmm. sometimes it's very difficult because there are so many barriers against people who have not graduated from college. Linda, you graduated from college?
Yes.
Has it helped?
I believe it has, Lauren.
You're sitting here?
Exactly. I think you've answered the question. But I think it is, it is interesting how the universities these days are looking at the students that they have. And, they're interested in their development, not only while they're in college, but where that college education is actually going to lead them. I also think that some of President Obama's ideas about being able to offer college education to those that would not normally be able to afford it through this program, through community colleges, is actually a great way to show people that, that there is an excitement in education, there is a use for education, and the mortarboard ceiling need not be there because of a financial reason. So I think that, on the whole, it's a great opportunity. Did you want to break in?
Yes, I did, because of station identification.
Please.
No, not an intellectual penetration. this is primarily for the benefit of our listeners on Sirius XM Radio, channel 124, the POTUS channel. You are listening to White House Chronicle with myself, Llewellyn King, Linda Gasparello of this program, and our very special and very gifted guest today, Naomi Thompson, who is the University of Rhode Island's Chief Diversity Officer. And it's really nice to have her on the broadcast, I can assure you. This program can be seen on 200 television stations and around the world on the Voice of America English language broadcasts on television and some of them on radio. Linda, you were saying?
No, just after you.
Oh, no. Well, I wanted to broaden this out. I wanted to get outside of the university and let that be and talk about society in general. Every time we have a terrible, nasty, unpleasant, ghastly racial problem like Ferguson, we suddenly decide that we need a more diverse police force, more diverse this, more diverse city council, more diverse newsroom in the radio or newspaper, and yet this happens every few years, and then we go back and find things have fallen back into the same old way. We talked a great deal about diversity. You're too young for this, Naomi, but I was in Washington during the riots of 1968, which physically tore the city apart, also emotionally and culturally tore the city apart after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And we went through all of these conversations about more diversity, community policing, policeman who looks like you, all of these things. And yet we don't seem to have quite got there. In Washington they have, because it's an African-American city council and there's some increased sensitivity there. But across the country that doesn't really seem to be the case, as we have found out in several instances, but particularly and most currently Ferguson, where I actually in your home state of or current state of Rhode Island, I noticed that suddenly they're saying there's not enough diversity in the police force. Didn't they know about this? Is this what difference will that make when you get diversity in Ferguson and Providence, Rhode Island, and I don't know where they're working actively at the moment, in California or some other state. And does that diversity have to extend to every segment of the population? Or are we talking in a much narrower way?
I think the broader you go, the more benefits the community receives from the diversity.
New York City seems to be having this problem, and it's always had some diversity in its police force.
Absolutely. But it's about diversity of thought, and as well as diversity and racial, ethnic, gender. The whole spectrum of diversity needs to be embraced. And I think the benefits of diversity is that it brings a certain empathy to the populations that you serve. And so if you have 10% of your police force or 1% of your police force policing a community that is predominantly African-American or predominantly Latino, the empathy is not there. But if the people who you are policing look like you or look like your mom or your child or your family member, you're more likely to be empathetic to their situation and less likely to shoot them.
And let's just look at something like racial profiling. I mean, you're less likely to have something like racial profiling if you've got a police force that happens to have that happens to be very diverse. I think racial profiling is one of the most awful, insidious, and true things that happens to people these days, who are of color, and you will get rid of that. And this is going to happen anyway, Llewellyn. I was just saying, what I just mentioned about the trends that we've got happening, there will be no majority America in a while. This is going to happen anyway. And this is going to happen not only in police forces, but it's going to happen in politics, too.
Absolutely. I mean, that's happening. And, we may have our disagreements or arguments with the present administration and with Barack Obama. But it is an incredible thing for America that it has an African-American president.
Well, it is.
It says, and that's why we were so euphoric when he was elected. I mean, there was a euphoria, a palpable euphoria, because we as a people had done this thing, this enormous thing that nobody thought we could do. which is overlook his color.
And actually, in the presidential election that's coming up, whether there are possible candidates or declared ones, we would have an African-American, we would have two women, if Hillary Clinton and Carly Fiorina both decide they're going to run, we would have two Cuban-Americans, Ted Cruz and
Ted Cruz is a Canadian.
All right, we'll talk about that later. We're talking about the question of native born,
all right.
Which is a constitutional question that has not really been settled by the courts. But and then we would have, as our third...
Marco Rubio,
of course. Yeah, so there. So
no, this is...
It's quite extraordinary.
I think it's extraordinary, but it's a reflection of the new America.
Yeah, it is.
What do you think, Naomi, is the impact of Barack Obama on the way we look at race?
Oh, incredibly impactful, and for communities of color, inspirational, that it's transformed the landscape of politics to a certain extent. I mean, there have always been folks who at different levels have been elected to political offices, but the fact that the president of the United States, who leads our country, is the most powerful individual in this country and potentially in the world, really speaks volumes to his competence. And I think the fact that he was elected once says something, but the fact that he was reelected and that the nation showed confidence in him to be reelected to president just speaks volumes about many folks' ability to see beyond race and many folks' ability to embrace that aspect.
I take a private joy in him. His father was an African. Mm-hmm. I was born in Africa. I'm an African. Mm-hmm. And I take a special joy that somebody from Africa, the son of somebody from Africa, an African from Africa, could be president of the United States. I think that's terribly important to Africa. Mm-hmm. But the difficulties it has with self-image, the 54 countries of Africa, I think that's hugely important. It's not something we dwell on in this country. Largely. Tell us a little more about yourself. Where did you go to school? How did you get into this field?
Well, I'm from Boston, Massachusetts, and I was fortunate enough to go to high school in Wellesley, Dana Hall School, all-girls school, which was very empowering for me as a woman. And then I had the ability to go on to Colgate University in upstate
New York. That's not a diversity thing when you have all women.
It is absolute a diversity thing because
okay, but no men.
Well, it's a diversity empowerment issue.
Well, I actually agree with you, but I'm just curious.
And actually, when I lived on campus, the majority of my dormitory was comprised of women from all over the world, and so that was my first, apart from my family experience, my first foray into diversity when I would live with women from Japan and Ecuador and Aruba and Miami and parts of Africa and the Middle East. And they were my schoolmates. They were my gym mates and classmates, and we studied side by side. So that was a real experience that taught me the value and the beauty of diversity and inclusion and inspired me to continue. And I went to Colgate, and then I went on to law school at Suffolk University in Boston, Massachusetts, where I practiced law for a bit after that, both in the civil and the criminal sectors. And then I fell into diversity work, working at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts, first in the Office of Affirmative Action and Diversity, which evolved into the Office of Institutional Diversity and Equity. And then that prepared me for the job that I currently hold now as the Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Rhode Island.
Fabulous career. What do you do when you're not working? Are you into sports or?
My passion is biking, actually, and I love to cycle wherever I go.
Do you go on these 300-mile rides and think nothing of it?
I wish.
A comfortable ride for you?
Oh, 20 to 30 miles, yeah.
Can we talk about the universities again? I'm sort of interested in how University of Rhode Island and definitely how your office reacted to the events in Oklahoma with the racial slurs by the fraternities. And is this something that you have spoken to the university about in...
Yes, we took a very proactive role.
Wanted to know.
We looked at ourselves. And
yeah,
we realized that, you know, in the world of diversity and inclusion, yes, it's wonderful to celebrate, but it's also sobering to look at the realities that we always have work to do. There's always room for improvement, always the ability to raise awareness and to check oneself at the door to say, you know, what are we doing? Are we doing the right thing? And to affirm our values. And the first thing that we did as an institution was look at ourselves and say,
what did you find?
You know, there are areas of improvement, of course, but as an institution, the leadership took a position that we do not condone this type of behavior, and, you know, we will not tolerate that type of behavior, and it's not appropriate.
Linda,
it's not
for
acceptable.
Our viewers and listeners, you might just expound a bit on what you're talking about. The Oklahoma.
This is where fraternity at the University
fraternity.
Yes, at the University of Oklahoma had a particularly awful
singing racist songs.
That's right. Just a
terrible ritual.
You
have fraternities, of course.
We do have fraternities and sororities. And, you know, as an institution, we acknowledge that those are not isolated instances. Those are just publicized instances. But when they do come to our attention, our administration and our student judicial board takes those matters very, very seriously, you know.
How do you deal with the faculty? Do you sit them down and talk to them and exchange views? And do they then talk to the student body? Do you address the student body directly? And are you preemptive or reactive?
Well, in an ideal world, you're proactive. But instances of racial discrimination, homophobia, heterosexism, are constantly happening, constantly in the media. And so if you pick up a newspaper on any given day, you're gonna see an instance of sexual assault, sexual harassment. There's not a day that goes by. And so are we reactive to ongoing pressures or ongoing issues? Maybe. Are we being proactive? Because we're always thinking about these issues. It is the job of the folks who work in the Office of Community Equity and Diversity to constantly be thinking about issues of diversity and how to get ahead of them, but also to deal with them when they come to our attention. And so, you know, we were proactive to a certain extent where we took a stand and made a statement and said, this is not behavior that we will condone, but when instances happen on a case-by-case basis, we look at them, we investigate them, and we take appropriate action when they do happen. I mean, there are 20,000 folks within...
I was just going to say 20,000.
20,000 folks within, excuse me, the University of Rhode Island, including students, undergrad, faculty, and staff. And it's inevitable when you have that number of individuals, that diverse of a population. Right now we have about 22% of our students come from traditionally underrepresented groups. But then diversity is much greater than that. And we have to think about how more than half of the population is comprised of women.
And the unique issues
that face them as well.
I have to bring this fabulous conversation to an end.
Okay.
I'm afraid we're out of time. Please come back. And it's been an honor and a pleasure to
Thank
have you.
You.
And good luck with your program. Most necessary, essential.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. We will be back next week, I hope, with a diversified panel. Until then, cheers.